He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears.
Our next person to interview is Colonel Joe Schweitzer. 1983 to 2006, he was an officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He was command of soldiers at the company, battalion, and brigade level to include in combat. Other assignments he had included assistant professor at the United States Military Academy, a NATO plan officer during combat operations in Kosovo, and he was also a maneuver support center chief of operations and headquarter, USACE, colonel retired. And I met Joe this last year, and he agreed to do these interviews. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is the second part of our interview with Joe Schweitzer, or Colonel Joe Schweitzer. And I'm here in the studios of the palatial Voice of Vashon with my service dog, Maya, who's right here at my feet asleep because she sees no treats in the bag right now, and my amazing engineer, Rick Ames, who gives me all the clues.
I see the dog gets higher billing than I get.
Well, yeah, that's... I hate to say it, but that's the way it goes. And the dog is also very good down here. You notice she... Yeah, she is just asleep down here. So we're going to talk to Joe a little bit more about his experiences in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And Joe, as we were talking last time, let's kind of bring people up to speed a little bit here. You were saying that, talk a little bit about when Iraq was first kind of challenging Kuwait, getting into a conflict there, and America's response to that.
So, my take on, and this is my take on this history, I'm sure it can be debated, but, you know, Iraq had gone, I think, to the UN and to the U.S. and had expressed concern about Kuwait drawing, you know, Iraq's economy had suffered greatly from its 30-year conflict with Iran, and Iraq needed revenue, and its principal source of revenue was oil. And there were a few oil fields that crossed the border between Iraq and Kuwait that were shared by both, and there was an agreement about how much oil could be drawn out of that. And, of course, because of supply and demand, if you draw less, the price per barrel goes up. Iraq had made an arrangement with OPEC, was a member, it was allowed to produce more oil than its normal in order to help refund its coffers that it had expended during its conflict with Iran. Kuwait didn't comply with the demands of OPEC, and Kuwait continued to produce oil, you know, at the same rate, and that was affecting the price per barrel. And then Iraq accused Kuwait of directional drilling into oil fields that were clearly in Iraq's sovereign territory. And because of that, the government goes to the U.S. and says, hey, we're concerned about this. This has got to stop. You got to get Kuwait to comply. And Ambassador Gillespie, she was the ambassador to Iraq at the time, told the Iraqi regime that, hey, whatever conflict you have is between Iraq and Kuwait and not us. And, that, you know, to me, that gave tacit permission to Iraq to do what it, you know, what it did, and that was to invade Kuwait.
And I can kind of, I can kind of see that in it saying, you know, they kind of perceived America as saying, we're not going to get our hands involved in this thing. And so when that message was gotten across to Iraq, they probably thought, well, at least we don't have to deal with United States coming in here and being on the other side. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because we were, we were friendly to both Iraq and Kuwait at the time. And but I think given the way Iraq invaded Kuwait, which was just sheer thuggery and looting and you know, raping and pillaging of Kuwait, and all these images, you know, real time now on CNN News, you know, the world took great exception, you know, woke up, the U.S. woke up and took great exception to this, and the U.N. got involved, and a U.N. charter was established that, you know, according to George Bush, the president at the time, you know, this will not stand. And so on 2 August, we deploy some of our air and airborne forces, Air Force and the 82nd Airborne and others. We deployed them into Saudi Arabia and established the line in the sand along the Saudi-Kuwait border. And that gave us time to set the theater for the combat operations. And during that, that same time, from 2 August to the actual start of Desert Storm, I think 17 January of 91, air operations began, bombing in Iraq proper. That time frame, you know, we were working to, you know, to get Iraq out of Kuwait to withdraw, and of course they refused to do it. And then, you know, we, during that time frame of 2 August to 17 January, we set conditions in the theater for combat, ground combat operations, air and ground combat operations. And for me, so I had seen my brother deploy in the 82nd on 2 August of 90. And, you know, we saw this play out. And at the time, you know, I know in November, December time frame of 90, we were actually out in the field. We were on Grafenwehr, Hohenfels, which were major training areas in Germany. We were out in the field training, and in the same time, you know, the wall is falling. You know, the Soviet Union is falling apart, and the wall that had separated Europe, separated Germany from East and West Germany, that began to disintegrate. And so we were out training. We did not believe we were going to deploy. In fact, I think we were told that the 8th Infantry Division, the unit I was a part of, we were not going to deploy. Other units, the U.S. and in Europe, were going to deploy. But on Christmas Eve Mass, we had a small, called a caserne, a small post, military post in Dex on Germany, 12th Engineer Battalion, and then there was an air defense artillery unit on the same caserne. But we were, I went to Christmas Eve Mass at a small chapel on our caserne in Germany, and the battalion commander told me that to assemble my officers on Christmas Day, that he had received word that the military was going to pull out of the 8th Infantry Division a separate tank battalion, the division artillery, divisional artillery, which a massive organization, massive amount of firepower. They were going to pull all of the DeBardi out, and then they were going to pull the 12th Engineer Battalion, the divisional engineer battalion out, and assign them to some ground forces that were also deploying. And eventually, so on Christmas Eve, we get the word, I assemble my officers, those that weren't on leave. We assemble on Christmas Day, and we get a warning order to prepare to deploy, and deploy to Saudi Arabia and conduct ground combat operations in Kuwait and in Iraq. And so from Christmas Day, we started to bring back all of my soldiers. This was the first time, because the wall was falling. We had, for decades before this, during the Cold War, we had a requirement to always have at least 90% of your soldiers on duty. So I could never let, on Christmases in the past, I could never let my soldiers anymore. Only 10% can go on leave at any one time. I had to have 90% of my soldiers. But because the wall was falling, we were allowed to, go on leave as normal. And so I was maybe down to about 20-30% of 168 soldiers assigned in my command. And this was pre-cell phones, pre-computers. This was, we had on landline call all of our soldiers who were back, many of them back in the U.S., and bring them back to Germany to deploy. I think around 7 January, my advance party underneath my company XO, Lieutenant Jeff Jenkins at the time, and big shout out to Jeff. He's the deputy public works there in Tacoma, the city of Tacoma, and still a lifelong friend of mine.
That's cool. That's Tacoma. Jeff, a big shout out to Jeff. Jeff Jenkins from Tacoma.
Yeah, Jeff deployed as a part of our advance party, and then the rest of us, soldiers were coming back off of leave. The rest of us, got our equipment ready, sent it up to Bremerhaven, Germany, a major port in Germany, to ship to the port of Dammam in Saudi Arabia in the Persian Gulf. And Jeff received the unit. We flew in. We received the unit. The ships came. We offloaded all of our vehicles. And we then deployed sort of out in the middle of the desert. In Saudi Arabia, we deployed along Wadi al-Batin, which is a very large dry riverbed. And we were, initially, we didn't have kind of a home. We were, as the army was, the theater was preparing its combat operations and its, order of battle, which is sort of the organization of units. We kept on getting assigned to an infantry battalion here, or, an armor battalion here. But we eventually, the task organization was set, and we were assigned to task organized as the engineer slice, the engineer company, and an armor battalion, task force 467 armored.
And let me ask you this. Now, you're with the engineer battalion, correct?
Well, we were an engineer company assigned to an armor battalion.
Basically, tell me kind of what kind of duties you did as opposed to the armored battalion.
So, and I love supporting armored battalions because they basically don't like to get off their tanks. So almost that's an homage to my father, an armored cavalry officer.
But, yes.
I mean, we basically, we had four missions in our armored battalion. And our mission was to provide mobility support. So that's to clear mines and minefields and allow the armor battalion, the tanks to move as they want to move on the desert floor. We provided counter mobility support. So if need be, we would lay mines and protect the flanks. We provided survivability support, which meant, and we did this every time we moved and stopped for any period of time, we dug in. Created pits for all of our assets in the task force, the armored task force. So in the event of an artillery strike or a Scud missile strike, they would be below ground and free of shrapnel. And then our fourth mission was to fight as infantry, the combat engineers, the fourth mission, if need be, is to fight like infantry, and we had the weapons and almost the vehicles to do that. So those were our four missions in support of Task Force 467 Armor, the Bandits, which was very well led by the Task Force Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Timothy J. Reichel, great man, great leader. And we talk about how, you know, we go into a conflict, you know, we went into Desert Storm training for the Cold War in Europe. And I really credit our combat training centers. And we have the Joint Readiness Training Center in Louisiana. We have the National Training Center in Fort Irwin, California. And in Germany, we had the Combat Maneuver Training Center, which we had just come out of in November, December timeframe, right prior to Desert Storm. But those combat training centers allowed this engineer company that was assigned to another division, 8th Infantry Division, to be picked up out of Germany, assigned to the 3rd Armored Division, 3rd Brigade, 3rd Armored Division, Task Force 467 Armor. And doctrinally, we were all on the same sheet of music. We picked up my task force commander, Colonel Reichel, was actually an observer controller at the National Training Center. He knew, you know, the schooling that takes place in the CTCs. And so when we, you know, coming out of the Combat Maneuver Training Center in Grafenwöhr, Germany, going to the desert in Saudi Arabia, we were totally on the same sheet of music. We knew their doctrine. We knew how to integrate with the armor battalion because of our combat training center experience. And I think this was Army-wide. And so we got assigned to 467 Armor. We're sitting in Wadi El Bateen prior to crossing the line of departure, prior to LD, which took place on the 24th of February. And prior to that, you know, air operations started 17 January 91 and continued on through the end of the conflict, which was about 100 hours later. We concluded combat operations, and we had set the theater with a massive amount of armor assets, not just tanks, you know, Bradleys, and the Army had undergone a major upgrade in its weapons. You know, we had the Humvee, we had the M1 tank, we had the Bradley fighting vehicle, we had our MLRS and multiple launch rocket system.
Was Iraq's military as I know you said they were the at that time the fourth largest military in the world, but was their equipment as advanced as that of the United States?
No, simply no. They had the latest in the tank, the T-72, I believe at the time, you know, that they had purchased from the Soviet Union. But they had T-55s. They had a lot of very old Cold War era tanks, and they did not modernize the way our Army modernized in the 80s. And that was a major advantage. And then our air operations, you know, a key part of our air operations were designed to both fool the Iraqi army in the way we set the theater and also to take their eyes away. You know, we took all of their radars and other surveillance systems. We took them out of the picture, and so Iraq was largely blind. And my division, 3rd Armored Division, that we were assigned to, and we were part of that left hook. So, you know, Schwarzkopf, his battle plans were, you know, we wanted Iraq to think we were coming in from the Persian Gulf and up directly from Saudi through Kuwait into Iraq along the coastline. But we had set a massive amount of ground forces out to the west in out in the middle of the desert, and that was that left hook. So we did, we came up through the coast. I think it was the 1st Infantry Division and Marines, a lot of other military units. We came up through the coast. But that was more of a feint. The real punch came from this left hook that we were a part of.
And also, if I'm correct, you know, we mentioned earlier about communicating on the battlefield, and at that time, we were, like you say, we didn't have cell phones that bounced off of satellites, and so once the ground radar and the ground communications were knocked out, that was a pretty big punch in the gut, wasn't it?
You know, for them, you know. Very much so. For us, we had actually, you know, another new piece of equipment, part of our modernization military, was this mobile subscriber communications equipment, MSCE, I think it's called. But we had basically set up cell phone towers and created a digital network throughout the theater. And, you know, we had these, like, mobile cell phone towers. And so in my M113 armored personnel carrier, which was my command track, I had a telephone. And that telephone, I could call back to the U.S. or talk to anybody on the desert floor from my vehicle. So we had, and we were really starting in a big way, this digital revolution, but we had the power of knowing what was happening to our left and right. We had, you know, we were connected to satellite imagery, to other, you know, aerial assets to provide us with an image of what was going on, the picture of what was going on in the battle. And then we didn't have, you know, the ability to these tracking systems, Blue Force tracking. We didn't have them yet. They came a bit later. But, you know, we had a good sense of, you know, our left and right.
Probably didn't you probably didn't have Netflix or Hulu then, but
we were far from that. But, and on the other side, with the Iraqi army, they had none of that. And so, you know, a typical engagement in my armored task force, the scouts would be out in their Bradleys. We had a wonderful scout platoon leader. Forget his name, but, you know, they would go out, they'd be maybe a kilometer or two in front of our formation. We typically moved in a large diamond formation, the armor, the scouts out front on the line, and then this large diamond formation, you know, the front of the diamond was mostly the M1 tank, and a typical engagement, the scouts would come in contact or see something, create contact so that we had a good view of who was awake and who was sleeping on the desert floor. And, you know, there would be some shooting back and forth. And then the tanks would come online. And the tanks, the M1 tank is an incredibly lethal platform. And if it can see you on the desert floor at night, in a blowing dust storm, if it can see you on the desert floor, you were dead with one shot from the 120 millimeter cannon on the tank. And so the, you know, 14 to 28, the two companies of tanks would come online. If not, the third company would all come online. The engagement would be done in, you know, 30 seconds to a minute or two. And then we would continue to move forward. So, So it was, there was a huge disproportionate Iraqi army and the U.S. army. We were very well trained. We were very well equipped. And although, you know, this formidable army, the fourth largest in the world, 30 years of combat experience with Iran, we had our combat training center experience, and we had the time, the best equipment on the battlefield by far. And so the conflict ended in 100 hours, and then we spent, you know, it ended on the 28th of February, and then we deployed back to Germany in May, and we spent the rest of our time destroying military Iraqi abandoned military equipment that they had abandoned on the desert floor throughout the desert. And so we expended all of our demo, our mines, our munitions, destroying Iraqi equipment. And we did that for several months. And then we went back to the port of Dammam in Saudi Arabia and put our equipment back on a boat. And we flew back to Germany and reunited with our loved ones waiting for us back in Dexham, Germany.
Wow, that's, I can't imagine moving that amount of equipment, first of all, from, you know, Germany, and basically was either moved by boat or probably some aircraft to the, you know, the big air buses that, you know, took tanks and everything else. But I mean, it's logistically not an easy thing to do. You must have had really good planners to be able to move that amount of equipment in that short period of time.
We had, you know, a great mind, you know, for the theater. I think his name was Lieutenant General Gus Pogonis. But he was the Desert Storm logistician. An army logistics is a big part of the heavy army. And so, you know, getting all the equipment there, getting it set in theater, sustaining it while it's there, you know, feeding and fueling. Those M1 tanks, you know, they burn like 400 gallons of diesel fuel or JP8. They burn that in about an 8-hour period. You know, it's a turbine engine, so it's less dependent on how many miles you drive. It's more on time.
So a little more than a... Little more than a Datsun hybrid then.
Exactly. And just think, you know, we had like 54, you know, just the tanks and Bradleys in our vehicle. We had 54 of them in Task Force 467 armor. So just think fuel alone. I mean, not talking water and food and bullets and just fuel alone, the logistics tail that would follow the units as they moved forward into Kuwait and southern part of Iraq. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know what? I think, if you wouldn't mind, Joe, I would like to carry this on, not necessarily today, but I would like to do another session on kind of going through from here to where we are now to... redeploying back to Germany. And so if you wouldn't mind, I will pay you the same amount for that interview as I am for this one. And
very good.
So
I can't refuse that offer.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and there's always the plus from Heritage too. We got to plug in for them too. So
absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate your time on this, and we'll talk just a little bit after this. So, Vashon, I know I'm not supposed to talk about the weather because that dates me, but boy, is it a great day. So goodbye, Vashon, and goodbye around the world. And thank you very much for listening to Is Abled with Dr. Steve Nurse and the very knowledgeable Colonel Joe Schweitzer.
Tonight.